This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. At Renegade University this Monday, I'll be teaching a live webinar. It's called Dangerous Nation, the United States and the World, 1776 to 1898. You can get all the information and register for the webinar at thaddeusrussell.com. When George Bush launched the invasion, occupation, and then reconstruction of Iraq in 2003, a lot of people said that this was a gross violation of the original principles of the United States, that the founding fathers never wanted America to be a global empire. But Bush and a lot of the supporters of Operation Iraqi Freedom insisted for years that in fact they were fulfilling the mission of the founding fathers, that they were in fact being true to the original principles of this country. In this course, I will present an argument that George Bush was right, that the United States, since its very founding, has been conceived and governed as a global revolutionary power with a duty, not just a right, a duty to remake the world in its own image. During the War of Independence, most of the founding fathers agreed with Thomas Jefferson, who said that the United States should become what he called the Empire of Liberty for all the people of the world. And when Jefferson was president, he launched the first invasion of a Muslim country in the Middle East. When Andrew Jackson removed the Indians from their land and pushed the country across the continent, he said he was doing it to advance the cause of freedom. Abraham Lincoln ordered the invasion, occupation, and then reconstruction of the Confederate States to remove the regime of the slaveholders and to bring freedom and democracy to the primitive backward South. When the United States seized control of Cuba and the Philippines in 1898, it immediately began nation building, including teaching several generations of Native people how to live like Americans. Most history teachers won't tell you this, but the American West, the American South, Cuba, and the Philippines, those were all the original Iraq. And this country was founded as an empire. This isn't being taught in the schools, but we're teaching it now. To register for this webinar, Dangerous Nation, go to thaddeusrussell.com. My guest this week wrote one of the most talked about political books of the year. It was supposed to be just a description of the rise of the alt-right, but it turned out to be a critique of nearly every facet of American politics. It's one of the most original and interesting books on American politics I've read in a long time. This is my interview with Angela Nagel, the author of Kill All Normies. So I'm here with Angela Nagel, and I'm really excited about this because I first heard her on a podcast about 6 months ago, and she had just published a book called Kill All Normies, which I guess this hadn't happened yet. I don't know how I heard about you on this why I was listening to this podcast, but soon after that, that book and you did something really, really extraordinary, which is it became a hit, and I don't know if it's technically a bestseller, but it has sold a lot of copies. I happen to know the number because I know the publisher, and he told me, and I won't say it here, but it is it's a big number, and especially for an independent small publisher like Zero Books, and especially for a radical political book, which is what it is. It's done extremely well. It's also been talked about in all the major media outlets. There's been reviews all over the place, some positive, some negative. But That, I don't know if you know, but that's almost unheard of for a book like that to do that well and to have that much impact is really something.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the fact that people, there was a point where I just thought there cannot be any more reviews of this book, you know, because like every single magazine, political magazine had to have either, you know, like a condemnation of it or something more positive. And, you know, it's sort of like every one of them had to weigh in, mm-hmm. even though there had already been dozens and dozens. Like, I don't even keep up anymore.
That's
I don't
right.
know.
They felt like they had to weigh in on this book. I mean, that's something. That means it's really important.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, how did that feel? First of all, I've never had that experience, by the way.
Yeah.
You know, I have two books and that's never been the case for me.
It was very stressful for while it was going on. But then after a certain point, I did kind of realize that ultimately that's the ideal thing that you want. You know, everyone in the world is like fighting about your book.
Mm-hmm. What was the first review, do you remember, that you heard about?
The first review, actually the first couple of reviews are really positive. So there was one in like a New York Magazine, one in Jacobin, one in like Stinging Fly, which is a literary magazine. They were all really positive. And I was thinking, wow, this is great. You know, I'm such a warm reception. And then the backlash began. And suddenly it was like every single day, you know, there was like hit pieces coming in and coming in and coming in. I was actually on holidays at one point, and every time I looked at my phone, a new hit piece, you know, was there like waiting for me.
Really? And were they attacking you personally?
Oh, yeah.
What were they saying about you?
They were saying most of the really nasty ones were coming from kind of like sectarian divisions on the left, you know? So, you know, the kind of Trotskyist line was very anti-Nagel.
Well, okay. So the Trotskyists don't like you, but, you know, that's about two dozen people.
They all write reviews.
You know that I'm ethnically Trotskyist.
Oh, really?
You know this? Yeah. I was born into a Trotskyist family.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know those people, and they might have enough people to field a softball team at this point. All the Trotskyists in the United States.
Yeah. But every single one of them has written a review of my book.
Yeah. Not something to worry about. Don't worry about that. But you got negative. Didn't you get some negative reviews in sort of mainstream outlets? Didn't you? Or no, maybe you didn't.
I didn't get like really savaged in anything other than the left-wing publications. With one exception, actually, there was one right-wing one that was very, very negative, which was like American Renaissance.
That's Jared Taylor's.
Yeah, that's
thing.
Right. Yeah.
I was just talking about Jared Taylor with this other guy who was in here earlier. That's funny. What did they say about it? Why did they not like it?
I think possibly it's because, well, I think it might be an age thing, or it might be the fact that their route to where they are now politically is so different from the one I was describing in the book that they would have probably just seen it as a total mischaracterization. But I was really talking about a particular sort of pipeline into the alt-right just a particular moment in kind of internet culture wars. It wasn't really just a description of the alt-right.
Yeah, you weren't claiming to make a comprehensive study of the alt-right as a whole, right?
Yeah.
You were just saying there was particular strains or tendencies.
Yeah.
In online culture in particular, right? And you're identifying them. So yeah, we'll get into like what that was. But so yeah, Jared Taylor, he's been doing this first of all for decades, and he's, you know, I think it is generational, but he's sort of aristocratic, you know, and he has actually an English accent that he uses even though he's American. And they've been trying to establish themselves for a long time as like these, you know, respectable intellectuals, like with an academic pedigree. He went to Yale, et cetera. So I can imagine, I don't know, but I'm sure he hates Milo Yiannopoulos and Gavin McInnes and all these people you're mostly talking about, right?
Yeah.
And you're talking about the countercultural sort of wing of the alt-right.
Yeah.
That's kind of your main argument, that this wing that was prominent shares a lot with the 60s countercultural, counterculture, right? That they're kind of just against conformism and they're, you know, for freedom of speech and free expression and individuality and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I can imagine that Jared Taylor, and he's an old school conservative.
Yeah, I don't think he's on 4chan.
That's the whole point of the alt-right, is that they hate each other, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, one of the fascinating things, I haven't read the review, but I heard that the National Review gave you a positive review.
Yeah, I think possibly the reason might be because Is it David French?
He gave you a positive review?
No, but I do mention him in the book and the way in which the pro-Trump kind of like people online attacked him when he went against Trump.
Right. They're never Trumpers.
Because
you are, it's a critique or an analysis which is not positive of the...
Yeah, so he may have
Trump
just...
Trump phenomenon, okay.
Yeah, so they may have just seen it as like in some way implicitly like sympathetic or something.
That's funny, yeah. So yeah, the New Republic liked it. The Jacobin, the socialist online magazine, loved it. And the National Review loved it.
Mm.
That's pretty weird.
Yeah.
Another exceptional thing about your book.
And Richard Spencer liked it too.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh God, what did he say?
He tweeted out something nice about it and Instagrammed
really?
It as well. And I remember like seeing it and thinking, oh no, I'm going to get crucified for this. And yeah. I did.
So what about identity politics people? Trotskyists are not identity politics people, but the identity politics, you know, style or type, what did they say about it? They must have hated it, right?
Well, I mean, the Trotskyist thing, you know, is always to chase after whatever the revolution of the week is, right? So right now they actually are entirely...
You just insulted my parents, by the way.
I know, I'm sorry. I'm sure they were
of
a much better time.
No, I say much worse.
but now that's what they're doing. So they're constantly chasing after, you know, it's like five people in the square and they think it's a revolution.
So they're talking about white supremacy now?
So now they're totally on board with the... really wacky identity politics.
Really?
Yeah. They won't hear any criticism of it. But the people that we typically associate with that term, they hated it too. I mean, they said it was... One publication said that this guy wanted to interview me for a socialist publication. And they said...
Fun. Those always go well.
And they said...
Always a good time.
They said to him that they did not want to platform me because I had enabled transphobia without actually engaging in it myself.
You enabled transphobia. Well, so here's a sentence from... I think it's just one sentence. Yeah, which is... Oh, no, it's two sentences, one paragraph at the end of one of your chapters. And I could see if I were Ta-Nehisi Coates or one of his acolytes, which is everyone at American universities these days, if I were one of them, I would want to punish you severely for this sentence, for these two sentences. The rise of Milo, Trump, and the alt-right are not evidence of the return of the conservatism, but instead of the absolute hegemony of the culture of nonconformism, self-expression, transgression, and irreverence for its own sake, an aesthetic that suits those who believe in nothing but the liberation of the individual and the id, whether they're on the left or the right. The principle-free idea of counterculture did not go away. It has just become the style of the new right. Now, you tell me, am I right that people who are invested in identity politics would really, really hate that?
Yeah.
Why?
I suppose because they want to claim that kind of cultural style for themselves.
You clearly have not been in the United States long enough. That's not why.
Oh, yeah? Why? Why do you think?
I wish that were their reason. I wish they wanted to be countercultural individualists. That has been dead on the left, at least in this country, since about 1972. And that's my great regret. And that's why I no longer consider myself a leftist, is that kind of old... What you're describing here is there are glimpses of it in the left in the United States, but much earlier in the 20th century. Now it's pretty much entirely puritanical in my view. And I think the argument in your book is pretty much in agreement with me on that. Mm. No, they would hate you for writing that. It's almost an act of violence, I think they would say, because you are not, you're saying that Milo and Trump, there's the word racist isn't in those sentences.
Yeah.
There are these other things which we associate often with good things: self-expression, individuality, transgression, irreverence. You know, those are good things. Those are not only good things for a lot of us, but those are kind of left-wing. We think they're left-wing ideas, at least traditionally.
Mm.
Countercultural. There's nothing in here about them being white supremacists.
Yeah.
And so that's all you must say.
Yeah.
These days, right? That's it. If you don't say that right away, you're basically in league with them, apologizing for them. It's really a crime. I mean, I've been called a collaborationist with Trump because I just said, yeah, he's not a Nazi. So it's interesting. I think the fact that you are not American and weren't living here when you wrote this, right?
No, I was in
Ireland. But that's what makes it good, though.
Yeah.
I think, because you have this outsider view.
Yeah.
You're not in this prison in which we're all terrified. Everybody's terrified of being called a racist or a Trump apologist or whatever, or a white supremacist. You're free of that. And I think that makes you free to be analytical.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, you know, I after getting sort of bashed for several months after this book came out, I did start to get into that mind frame a lot, actually, you know, of being terrified as well. Mm-hmm. And thinking, how can you really write anything? Because nothing will ever be taken in good faith and nobody will ever read. Like, to this day, like a friend of mine was saying to me, people regularly, when they get into arguments about me or about the book, talk about the Nagel thesis. By which they mean, well, I wish, like, I mean, it sounds kind of fancy, but what they actually mean is they have condensed my argument down to teenagers posting on Tumblr caused the rise of the far right. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's like, I mean, it's so, like, that is not what I'm saying, you know, and it's just intentionally, you know, dumbing down the argument to a point of total absurdity so as not to deal with any of the complexity of what I was saying.
Yeah. That is a line of argument in your book, but that is one of many, many, I think, that you use to explain the rise of the alt-right.
Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about it. What is your argument? What is the argument to kill all normies?
I think there's actually, I don't think there is one kind of central argument, really. I mean,
I agree. I see many. Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of different things going on in it. I mean, I guess I wanted to try to describe lots of different kind of online subcultures that emerged around the same time.
Left and right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And how they interacted with each other or how they had some kind of a symbiotic relationship. Because one of the things I was thinking is like all of this would be forgotten very quickly. And so it was worth documenting as well, because they were all very conscious of each other, you know? So like from the outside, it would just seem like they were, you know, it was all kind of vaguely pro-Trump, right? But internally, of course, they're all fighting. Even, let's say, the right-wing ones. The manosphere people are fighting with the, like, alt-right or fighting with, like, you know, and they have, like, you know, oh, yeah, and, of course, the divisions between the alt-light and the alt-right are very big as well and very, at this point, personal. And so I just wanted to sort of map that out. That was the main goal.
You come from cultural studies, right? Don't you have a degree in essentially cultural studies?
Yeah.
So we would call that in our business co-constitutive identities, right?
Yeah.
In other words, that one's identity is created in opposition to the other. So it becomes your identity actually is dependent on the other. And so I think that's what you're describing here is that the so-called alt-right is basically establishing an identity in response to, in reaction to the left or what it sees as the left and then vice versa. So I am this is the opposite of that. So you need the other. So they need each other is what you're saying, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you actually see kind of ideas kind of solidifying in some way in reaction against another group that they're arguing with, you know. So an interesting thing, like recently, you know, the alt-right have gotten into these kind of scraps with Jordan Peterson online.
Have they?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
What's this?
And he was describing them as he describes them as collectivists, right? And he sort of says the left and the right are essentially the same because they're all collectivists. And so then they, you know, almost in response to that, they now are kind of like weirdly flirting with like communist imagery and stuff like that. Like, I just, it's hard to explain, but I just see these things kind of like remolding themselves all the time as groups kind of define themselves against other groups.
It's funny, I would have thought Peterson's critique of the alt-right would have been a different one, which is that they're a bunch of wankers. wankers. Like, yeah, they struck me, one of the things that struck me when I was reading your book, reading their discourse, the discourse that came out of the alt-right, or what you're calling the alt-right here, is a lot of the language and a lot of the ideas about sex come straight out of porn.
Yeah.
Like, it's almost cut and paste from like porn movies. The way they conceptualize sex and think about it and talk about it, it's like, yeah, the only way you would have that idea, you would say that about sex, is you've watched a lot of porn.
Mm.
I really think pornography, and I'm totally pro-porn, but I think pornography really kind of almost established the language for those guys. And since we know pretty well, right, that they're young men we're talking about here, makes sense. But, Peterson's no fan of that.
Yeah, I mean, and he's very much into, like, they often make fun of him as saying, like, tidy your bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
So he's very
clean,
much into...
Clean up your room, that's his,
yeah,
that's his
clean
famous
up your room, yeah,
line,
yeah. So it's like individual responsibility and that kind of thing. Whereas, yeah, I mean, I suppose... In those arguments, in those type of arguments, they end up sort of becoming more entrenched, I guess, in a position of defending, you know, the collective good and things like that.
So this is where it's really important to draw distinctions, right, between the people we're talking about. There's various kinds of people who we associate with the alt-right or who associate themselves with the alt-right. So there are those who really are intellectuals. They're very serious. They have an intellectual and political project. Mm. You know, they've developed this over years. They're very rigorous in their analysis. And they don't talk in pornographic terms.
Yeah.
And they don't just send stupid memes to people that are just deliberately racist or, you know, shocking. So that's, I think that's a very small group, right? And you talk about them, like this guy, Moldbug. What's his name? Mencius Moldbug and NRX Ret and people like that. Like, there's a serious intellectuals. Jared Taylor, serious intellectual. I mean, I think he's not the brightest, but he's, you know, it's a real intellectual project. He wants to be serious about this. It's a political effort. It's very rational. So then, again, I think that's like, we're talking in the maybe dozens.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and none of them get published in major media outlets.
Yeah.
And they're never on TV. So they're not that important, at least in the culture. They've been made important, I think, by the media, but they don't really have a place in the establishment. Okay. So that's a tiny little fraction. But then you have this sort of ocean of anonymous people online, and that's mostly who you're looking at, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the thing.
That's very different, a very different group. And I think that's who's getting pissed off at Peterson, maybe, right?
Yeah.
Because he's telling them to put away the porn and clean up your room, and they're like, no, they're all about porn
and
living in their mom's basement.
Well, but also, I mean, there is this weird thing where, I mean, like porn obviously had such an influence on like the culture of 4chan and stuff like that. But then there was... I think you could say there was an almost like Weimar, like counter reaction. Do you know what I mean? Like they kind of pushed they saw the kind of furthest extremes of what you can see online, and were almost, I wonder, I mean, it's a theory like that they may have been so horrified by it, or possibly even like slightly traumatized, that they like, you know, reacted to it in a very extreme way, that they felt very much like, you know, the world is this dark place that has been destroyed essentially by the sexual revolution.
Okay.
Because then they went into, you know, because it's interesting that they were in that gruesome porn world of 4chan. And then where people would just post things because they were gruesome and horrifying and offensive and stuff like that.
Yeah, by the way, just so we're clear, we're not talking about sort of typical porn you would see on Pornhub. We're talking about, I haven't been on 4chan, I don't even know, but I'm assuming that it's like the most extreme, violent, racist, misogynist, you know, rape fantasy kind of porn, right? That's what they're trafficking in?
Yeah.
And that's what, and you're saying, so they went all the way down that hole.
Yeah, I think so.
And then they got scared, possibly.
Yeah.
And had the response that a lot of Germans did in 1933 to similar things that were going on in Berlin, which at the time was full of gay nightclubs and drag queen shows and all this stuff.
Yeah.
And a lot of them went for the authority figure, an authoritarianism to cleanse us of this. So it's interesting.
Yeah, because then they ended up, ended up calling for kind of, they would say like a sexual counter-revolution.
Right.
To bring everything, because they had very much a sense that like, basically liberalism had destroyed everything and had destroyed sexual relationships, and they could no longer be sort of innocent.
And you're talking about the anonymous young men online here.
Yeah,
okay. Not the serious intellectual types.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, that's, you know, so, some people have said like, you know, that people who kind of study this tend to, especially if they're academics, like they tend to be very protective of their little area that they study, you know what I mean? So like one person was saying to me recently, what about the militia movement? Like they were there in Charlottesville and they're nowhere in the analysis.
Right.
I mean, that's not what I was writing about. But also I would say that, you know, the far right is kind of always there on the fringes in small numbers.
Mm-hmm.
What was different about this was that, as you say, it was this ocean of like, it was this very large number of anonymous people online who were able to kind of boost it into mainstream media and make it of interest to mainstream media and you know, engage in all these kind of like tricks and pranks with the mainstream media to get their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just able to marshal that kind of force of just, you know, very large numbers of anonymous people online.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what made it different. You know, it wasn't that. So that's why when people say, you know, for example, well, there was only, you know, 50 people at the last NPI. I don't know if it was exactly 50, but whatever, 50 to 100.
NPI is
National Policy Institute.
Oh, NPI, Spencer's thing?
Yeah, okay, yeah.
How many, 50?
I'd say 50, 60, something like that.
Yeah, right.
But the thing is, you know, all of those people online, I mean, you know, they're not there, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they still count because they're still able to... They were still definitely very present, particularly in that kind of Trump election moment.
Yeah. So in Germany in the 1930s, obviously, a significant portion of the population joined the Nazi Party or fully supported the Nazi Party. Now, the Nazi Party had a serious project that was seriously racist. They didn't mess around. Like, if you had any Jewish ancestry, you were... to be eradicated. You couldn't exist. You were going to despoil the pure Aryan nation, right? They didn't play around with that stuff. They had a whole taxonomy of all the world's races, and they were going to deal with this very methodically. And they were going to march the Jews out, by the way. That was their plan, not to kill them, because killing them was what the stupid Slavs in Russia did in the pogroms. Hitler's idea until the very, very end was to, we have to do this orderly, called it the anti-Semitism of reason, as opposed to the anti-Semitism of emotion.
Mm.
So they had this, it was a very well thought out, very methodical thing for the Nazis. They were very serious about their racism. And I don't see that in the alt-right.
Yeah.
Even among some of the intellectuals, I think even Jared Taylor, when asked who is white, he equivocates.
Mm.
And he's even said that Jews are white.
Mm.
He's like, well, I don't, you know, obviously they're white. Look at them.
Mm.
It's just like, no, a guy, come on. You're not very good at being a racist here. And Richard Spencer, when I first heard about him, I thought, well, okay, what is this ethnostate? Like, who gets to be in it? And I heard someone asked him that question on a podcast, and I was listening. He said, oh, well, I'm not terribly, you know, strict about the rules about who's white and who's not. What is this? What do you mean? Being a racist is a serious thing. It's a serious project, right? You're kind of drawing hard lines around these groups, and you're saying that there are genes associated or attached to races of people that will bring down a civilization if they're allowed to flourish.
Mm.
If you allow someone with an inferior gene, racially inferior gene, to breed with someone else, next thing you know, we're just in chaos.
Mm.
And so I don't know what's going on with these guys. Like, it's very curious to me. They're kind of the opposite of what the left hysterics are saying about them in some ways. I mean, sure, what they say is technically racist. There's no doubt about it. But if you're that loose about your definitions, how much do they really want a separate ethnostate? Like, do they really have plans to put this into practice, or are they really thinking about, you know, expelling people did you feel that? Do you see that in the, among the alt-right, that they're not terribly serious about this actually?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the difference is that, you know, the West in general, but I mean, America in particular, is such a mixed society now that, like, it's not really comparable to Germany. You know,
Berlin was full of Jews.
Right. But I mean, it wasn't full of people from everywhere in the world, okay. You know, to the same extent. So, you know, I think that their idea is basically that a movement that is going to be, you know, have real force behind it, that's going to be revolutionary, has to have a telos, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, even if you're not going to, like, impose this tomorrow, you have to have this vision. So it's very much like their idea is like, it's like white Zionism, mm-hmm. that they would have this dream of a homeland. And it's true that they're not very particular or very strict. I definitely see that. But I mean, they do talk about, like, eugenics and stuff like that. Oh, yeah. They do talk about how, a kind of a 100-year plan, you know, and stuff like that. And how even when they got a white ethnostate, even within that, they would practice eugenics and, you know, make sure that
good for them. I guess I was underestimating them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what's always struck me about them, you know, that they're not very serious about this, but I could be wrong. You know, if they had state power, who knows, right? And that would be a whole different ballgame. And they might change their mind, or they might start drawing up real specific plans real fast if they got state power. But
yeah,
they're very far from that, so I'm not terribly concerned about it. But so I'm sure you got criticized for you're not even really criticizing the alt-right in much of the book. It's not really clear that you're critical of them, right? You're just sort of trying to analyze them and understand them.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm trying to describe them or describe certainly the online version of it. I think part of the reason I did that, I mean, was that the tone of so much of what's written about them is so highly emotional that I wanted to not just be neutral or something like that, because I am expressing opinions in it, but just to not sound hysterical, basically.
Yeah. So to what extent do you argue, or do you think, that the left caused the alt-right, created the alt-right?
I think that both sides in the online world that I'm describing sort of became more extreme in response to the other. So it's maybe, I don't know, like, which came first, or, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where you would, where the blame would lie or something like that. But it's more that just that I was noticing that, like, both sides were looking at the other side. And so, for example, if you were, like, a teenager in this kind of emerging right-wing internet world, you would be looking at, like, you know, people on Tumblr who are, you know, just, like, whatever, really crazy social justice warrior people.
You know, I've never looked at Tumblr.
And you would be saying, you know, this is basically what the future will be like if we don't do something. Uh-huh. Like, so just as an example, I remember somebody saying, it really struck me as a good example of this, because I don't care that much about video games, so I've never felt passionately about them. And I found it difficult to understand the level of passion that was there in the whole Gamergate thing. But I do remember a Gamergate person saying, tweeting out, like, a feminist, like, criticism of their favorite video game, and he said, this is what you're going to be listening to forever, basically. You know, you will never get to enjoy culture again, because from now on, these people are just in control, and they're just going to berate you and destroy everything you love, and so on. So, I mean, that is, you know, I can see why somebody would have a very extreme, you know, emotional reaction to that. So essentially, I'm kind of saying, you know, and I also remember hearing like Red Ice, who are an alt-right, like, they're quite far right. They're quite far right. We'll just say they're open anti-Semites and stuff like that. I remember them interviewing, I think it was Spencer before, and he said something like, this was well before, like, Trump or anything like that, and he was saying, you know, social justice warriors are just such a gift. I wish I could find a way to fund them, because they're such a gift for us, because they're just like converting masses of like teenage boys to the right, you know. Mm-hmm. So that is a fact, you know. And the thing is, people who were annoyed with me for saying that said, oh, you're blaming the victims and you're saying that like harmless like teenage girls on Tumblr are to blame for that. Of course I'm not saying that, but I am saying that, you know, that connection is there, and I'm not going to lie and pretend that it isn't there.
Yeah, they need each other.
Yeah.
Co-constitutive identities is what you should just say to people like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, I've heard a friend of mine was saying to me recently, he has a nephew who's sort of like 9 or 10 or something like that, and he was saying, my nephew will probably be alt-right by the time he's like in his early teens. You know, I hear a lot of people saying stuff like that, you know. There is this sense that like there's nowhere for teenage boys who feel kind of personally insulted by the fact that they're being personally insulted, or they're being insulted as a group, mm-hmm. To go, you know, other than there. There's nowhere else where you can just be, you know, irreverent, and you can just stand up for yourself and stuff like that. So that's a dangerous situation.
Yeah. So let's see. I once wanted to write a book called The Uses of the Redneck, because it became clear to me that liberals in this country have established their own identity and their own politics, really, in opposition to an imagined racist redneck in the South. And that, so that figure of the racist Southern redneck has been front and center in all liberal discourse since about World War II. Mm. So the establishment of racial liberalism and this whole regime that we now live in, which is the dominant way we think about race now, even among conservatives, that was established basically in opposition to this imagined racist South, and particular white people in the South, you know, which it's, first of all, it's debatable whether, to what extent that's true, even that description of those people. In fact, I think that by and large, white Southerners, working class white Southerners, are less racist in many important ways than liberals in New York are.
Yeah, well, this is the same everywhere. Working class people are more integrated.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the South?
I was actually born in Texas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Not exactly the South, but maybe, I don't know, I've never been to Texas.
Is that not the South?
I mean, not really. Okay. Texans will tell you they're their own place. It's okay, their, you know, right. Texas stands alone. Most people don't associate Texas with the South, but in the Deep South, so-called Deep South, you know, Louisiana, Georgia, South Carolina, I've spent a fair amount of time in those places. You'll see immediately, almost when you get off the plane, that there are white people and black people just hanging out together, eating in restaurants together, walking together, talking together, casually. Mm-hmm. And there's just not this kind of intense self-consciousness and consciousness about race that you find in northern cities. There's also, I think the numbers are there. I think there's a much higher incidence of interracial couples and marriages and all that. And you'll see it too. You'll see lots of couples that are black and white, much more than in New York City.
Yeah, no, it's always the way. And the rich sort of rich whites tend to be the most preachy on this issue. And yet, if you just look at their patterns of where they live, I mean, they're always in the white flight kind of neighborhoods and stuff.
On the other hand, it is true that white working class Southerners are much more likely to say nigger.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
and not just rhetorically, but like directly to a black person.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what is most often the case is that they live next door to that black person
and they've
known that black person for a long time and may even be friends with them. Mm. And that's the difference. So sure, you know, is that racism? I suppose of a sort, but to me, it's far less powerful than the kind of paternalism. Mm. Which I think that's the liberal form of racism in the North. I think that's an important, helps understand sort of the emergence of the alt-right, I think, to some extent, because as you were saying, I think it's a very important frame you have, this co-constitutive thing where the identities are formed in opposition to each other. Mm. The thing that I worry about or think about when I hear about some political ideology or political movement that I don't like the sound of is, are they expansionist? Are they evangelical? Do they want to make me live, you know, in their regime? And that's what I don't see on the alt-right. I don't see them wanting to establish the United States, or establish a new, overthrow this government and establish a new white supremacist government or fascist government. I mean, if they did, all bets are off and I'm definitely getting an AK-47, but I don't see that. So Does that make sense?
Yeah.
To you?
I mean, I think in terms of fascism, like their view would be very much that, you know, the approach to the state or the economic system or whatever it might be, that all of that is up for debate. What is not up for debate is the demographics. So they would say demographics first and everything else is debatable and can be, you know, dealt with later.
Right.
And I mean, the thing is, there is no way of achieving their goals. I mean, this is what I've met them and I've said this to them and stuff, you know.
Who have you met?
I met Richard Spencer and I met some people at the NPI conference. I didn't catch their names, so I talked to some random people. I just think...
do they want to take over?
Well, how do you get a white ethnostate, right? Unless
you can leave. We can give them, you know, Greenland or someplace and they can go there.
Yeah, but see, that's not clear either because I can't see that they're going to give up, you know, all the great cities and stuff like that, you know. So, I mean, they do talk about it and it's not very concrete, but like they do actually talk amongst themselves on each other's podcasts and stuff like that about how they might potentially go about it and
like,
what parts of America are still relatively white or are less populated and all that kind of stuff.
So if you're an anti-racist, give them Wyoming. Isn't that the best thing? We would get rid of them.
Yeah, no, I don't think they'd be happy with that. I think they want the whole thing.
They want more? Oh, they want the whole country.
Yeah, yeah.
You think? Okay. Well, here's what I know, though. They're not universalists, obviously, by definition.
Yeah.
Right? They don't want to expand their ideology or their regime globally.
No, but I suppose you could say, I mean, one of the big influences, certainly in the...
Or maybe I'm wrong.
Well, in a way, right? So it's almost like one of their big influences is the French New Right. And... In particular, identitarianism, meaning that people should have the right to not mix with others and that people should preserve their own unique culture. And that it's a loss for people to just have a melting pot and integrate. So if you would say to them, well, what if we made this project work? What if integration really did work? They would say that would be terrible because you would actually destroy all of the cultures that you would be integrating. So in a way, it's almost like they would probably argue that there is some kind of a universalism in that in a way, because they're saying everyone has the right to this unique, you know, identity, and that it's essentially a racial identity.
That's usually called particularism.
Yeah,
which
I know.
Which is the opposite of universalism.
Yeah, I know. It is the opposite of universalism,
okay.
Actually.
I was just wondering if I'm right that's what they're committed to. I know that I'm pretty sure that Jared Taylor is. He's perfectly fine. He wants, in fact, I think he wants every race to have its own ethnostate.
Yeah.
So, you know, that makes them to me way less scary. They have no, I don't know about Spencer, but I don't think he has any interest in global domination.
No.
It's not a universalist movement or a globalist movement.
Yeah.
In fact, they're anti-globalist explicitly.
Yeah.
But does that apply to their own ideology, right?
Yeah. No, they're definitely, they want America to be completely isolationist, actually.
Yeah.
And they want an end to, you know, any involvement, basically military or otherwise, not any involvement with the outside world, but you know what I mean? Good fences make good neighbors, they would probably say, but just a general withdrawing of these kind of quasi-imperial
forces. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm basically an isolationist now.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I used to kind of think you could somehow be like anti-war and an internationalist as well and stuff like that. But now I just think, you know, if you're in a major Western military power, particularly the ones that have a tendency to keep invading the Middle East, your only job is to be an isolationist, you know, and you cannot. So, for example, when the protests were happening in Iran, I shared this you know, an article just defending Jeremy Corbyn's silence on the issue, right? Because everyone was saying, why have you not made a statement on this? You know, and you must make a statement. Why is this person silent? You know, and this, like, everyone sort of on Twitter demanding that these English-speaking people who are just talking to each other make statements about this. And I was just thinking, you know what? Actually, don't make a statement about it. It's none of your business. Mm-hmm. Stay out of it. Like, how many times do we have to repeat the same thing? And it's a disaster every time. And yet people still keep saying, you know, people keep getting like wrapped up in this kind of like the emotion of the moment, you know, and seeing, imagining this kind of brave struggle going on, which they, you know, and it's like, ultimately, look, you're just talking to your English speaking friends. It has no influence on people in Iran. Hmm. And the only influence we're likely to have is a negative one. So just stay out of it.
I have never, until this moment, heard a leftist say that they're an isolationist.
Yeah.
So you were born in Texas. I don't think we've said this yet, but you were raised in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
And in Dublin?
Yeah.
And so you're Irish. And so have you been a part of the European left in any formal sense? The Irish left?
Yeah. I mean, kind of more in campaigns and stuff like that. Like, so, you know, for example, one of the great, like, well, actually, I had become quite apolitical for years. And the thing that made me political again was the huge bank bailout that happened in Ireland. Mm. And the banking crisis, which was basically bailed out with public money. And it was done in a kind of nighttime meeting that, and it was just announced to the nation the next day, like, mm-hmm. sorry, we've just spent all of your money.
Pretty much what happened here.
Yeah. Yeah, and that really politicized me because it was just such an outrage, you know, and it completely restructured the Irish economy, basically, to bail out these kind of private gambling debts. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of became very interested in the fact that this was happening in particularly like in Greece and in other European countries. The culmination of that in Ireland was probably the movement against the privatization of water. You know, where actually, I mean, at that point, it was like the whole place had been robbed and it was like the one thing that was left over that people were just sort of clinging on to because the robbery had happened in the middle of the night and it was too late to actually to do anything about it. But anyway, but those kind of anti-austerity movements were kind of repoliticized me.
Okay. And austerity, your analysis, which this is more or less my analysis, was imposed by internationalist institutions, right?
Yeah.
So I take it you're for Brexit.
I have very mixed feelings on it. I was very, I mean, the pro Europe campaign or whatever, the Remain campaign was really horrible in just in so many ways. I mean, it was so elitist and anti-democratic and nasty
and anti-immigration.
Yeah, well, the pro-Brexit side. I mean, ultimately, I actually have very positive feelings about. Maybe this makes me a cosmopolitan elitist. I don't know, but I have actually very positive feelings about that kind of European cosmopolitanism, you know, mm-hmm. like there are all these things that the European Union did, like, you know, they give like free interrailing passes to 18-year-olds and they do Erasmus programs so that college students will go and study abroad. And that opening up of Europe was actually a very wonderful thing. It's like, you know, I remember it very distinctly as being this great thing where you could just get on a short flight and suddenly you were in a new country with a new language, different architecture. You know, you could go to Italy and see, like, look at how elegant everything is and how much people are devoted to, like, leisure and food and pleasure. And then you go to Spain and it's, like, beautiful public squares and you go to the Nordic countries and you look at the amazing mm-hmm. welfare state that they have and you think about what, you know, and so you start to bring kind of the best of these things home and be more maybe critical of your own government and your own system. So I have really positive feelings about all of that. On the other hand, you know, clearly the EU, you know, did impose, you know, it means that you have less democratic control of your own life because there is this thing that your, you know, some previous governments have signed something that says that you can never bring in a certain economic policy or whatever it might be. So it is anti-democratic.
Mm. Or it's perfectly democratic because it's creating a larger demos and giving that demos more power to determine more in the world.
That's true. But I think at a certain point, it gets too big. Mm. I think that demos is too big.
Yeah. So it's funny, as you were talking about the EU and what it gave you, according to your own values, which sound a lot like my values, like the idea of traveling freely between countries and among and in, within countries, it's exactly what I want. So there's two ways you can do that. One is you can just constantly advocate for open borders for everybody, right? And you can do that by making the country you're living in be open borders, which serves as a model maybe for other countries. That's not always going to be effective, but that's one way. And then the other way is to establish a continental or global government that forces all the countries to eliminate their borders, which is basically what the EU did, right? And so that's tough. I mean, for a lot of reasons, but for one thing, there has to be some homogenization going on there. The EU did establish lots of protocols and standards that were universally applied. Otherwise, there's no such thing as an EU, right? And so that did damage to local cultures. And I mean, the currency is just the most obvious example, but there's no longer all these different currencies. And now there's one currency. And that's not that important, but, you know, it is indicative of what must happen if there is a forced integration, right, of all those people living on that landmass. And so you talked about the alt-right being opposed to integration, and I think they're really opposed to forced integration. So like when in this country, after the civil rights movement, one of the first policies, and actually I was in the very first group of school children in the United States who was bused, but that was the first real policy to create integration in northern cities, like where I'm from in Berkeley, that involved moving people across town every single day, children, putting them on buses and moving them to different parts. It's this massive social engineering project that's really gross. And it also is reminiscent of totalitarian regimes who did just that. You know, they decided, oh, we need farms over here, so let's move all the peasants from this part of the Soviet Union to that part. Or obviously the Nazis did this too in other ways. If you're interested in free movement and cosmopolitanism, which I totally am, there's no great way to get that. But I think that a massive overarching government like the EU, it will get you not a cosmopolitanism. It will get you a unipolitanism. It will get you, right, a one world. It will get you a single culture, ultimately, because that's what it requires, I think. Or at least there will be a great diminution of diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder sometimes if the, as I mentioned, the Erasmus programs, which encouraged like college students to study abroad, were actually to even have like, you know, people having children who are from, you know, different places in Europe, like having them in different countries. I don't know. But yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, after two world wars, you can kind of see why Europeans would want to blend everything a little bit and not have these, blood and soil kind of nationalism.
It also, frankly, I think it's really more probably what you're talking about, though. It's like people love from Northern Europe, as you know, love to go vacation in Southern Europe. And so it's now easier to go hang out on the beach in Greece for a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah.
Same currency. The transportation is all integrated. I get that. Totally get that. If it were just that, I'd be really sympathetic, but that's not what they were about. I mean, right? Don't you think? I mean, there was an effort to homogenize that continent.
Yeah, quite possibly. I've honestly never really thought about that, other than that sense that, you know, there was certainly a feeling of like almost like trying to give people that. Like, I remember, for example, loads of EU propaganda when I was in school. In fact, because Ireland kind of developed quite late, you know, and developed a lot of like its infrastructure quite late, I remember like a kind of a new like road. This makes it sound like very like behind the times or whatever, but a new kind of a road, and it had a gigantic EU flag, like billboard type of sign on it. And it was saying like the EU built this, you know, and it was just a reminder of like, you know, trying to make people you know, associate the EU with this like developmental
a road, a yeah. road. Yeah. So, you know what other roads are still in Ireland? Roman roads, right?
Yeah.
There you go. There's another international globalist empire that was trying to, that did extend its own culture to where you grew up, right? Another homogenizing influence or attempt to homogenize the world, right? That was explicitly the mission of the Roman Empire, was to make all the world Rome.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what the American Empire has been for about 200 years, explicitly. Mm. Well, not so much explicitly lately, but for a long, long time. Now they're kind of just, they're quiet about it. But the neocons were explicit about it pretty much. But American policymakers for centuries have been saying, oh no, yeah, we need to make the world more like us. That's why we need all those military bases all over the world to make sure, and we need to have school teachers, more importantly, in all those countries, you know, all the Peace Corps activists and volunteers teaching all the people of the world to live the way that we do. Same project, universalist, globalist, and that's really, I think, what Trump was in opposition to, what the alt-right is in opposition to, what the Brexit movement was in opposition to. It's in opposition to many things that are part of that. But
I mean, that was a crazy ideology and a crazy regrettable like period of American history, I think.
Which
that,
one?
That end of history neocon sort of moment.
Oh, we've never not been in that.
Yeah.
That's my point.
But of specifically, you know, trying to make the world American through military intervention.
We've never not been in that. That's what I'm saying is it has been American foreign policy since 1802.
Yeah.
Since Thomas Jefferson sent the Marines to Gallipoli, I mean, not to Gallipoli, to Tripoli, and to take out the Barbary pirates, who were Islamists, by the way. But for ever since then, I mean, explicitly, they've said this, you know, this is, we got to make the world in our, remake the world in our image. But you just look at the policies. I mean, they don't say it now. Obama, well, you know what? Even Obama basically said this too, if you look at his speeches about foreign policy. But if you look at the actual policies, right, all these, there's all this foreign aid that goes to these organizations that are basically teaching people in Africa and Asia things like Western feminism and gay rights. And, you know, I'm basically a feminist and for gay rights here, sure. But like, this is nonetheless cultural imperialism, but backed up by state power, you know?
Yeah.
And development, like economic development, has always been a huge part of American foreign policy, giving money and helping funding nations to develop in particular ways, build dams, build bridges that are, so you become like a good Western civilization. So I'm writing a book basically on this, you know, on the,
it's very interesting. It's such a strange, it's such a strange project. I mean, you know, and I remember like, say, when Trump got elected and everyone was freaking out and I was suddenly having to redraft my book a little bit.
Yeah.
I do remember thinking, you know, okay, what's the worst case scenario? What's the best case scenario? And I do remember thinking, if he builds loads of infrastructure and doesn't invade anywhere, really, really is an isolationist, that will be good, you know, and that may be a, well, in a way, it's like admitting like the America is no longer going to be the great superpower of the world, and it would have been a great thing.
So when you say that the alt-right is defined principally by its individualism and anti-conformism, that's what you're saying, though. It's not just individualism for its own sake, but you're saying it's in opposition to this globalism.
Well, again, the thing that I was describing there was really more the Milo Yiannopoulos wing of things, right? So
the alt-right. Okay.
So the alt-right would actually be quite anti-individualist. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have much more of a collectivist kind of...
But collectivist, but localist, right? Like Burke, like Edmund Burke in a way. Aren't they for sort of the local community tradition in the locality? That's Pat Buchanan.
Yeah.
Paleoconservatism.
Yeah.
Which is really Burkean.
Yeah.
Aren't they essentially Burkean?
Well, I think ultimately, the thing is, ultimately, to put it as simply as possible, it is just about race for them.
Hmm.
You know, everything else is negotiable.
Well, race and soil. Isn't it? Don't they attach their race to soil?
Yeah, sure.
Particular soil?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I've been writing this book. I mean, started it long before Trump was even a possibility of president. But just trying to to write the history of what we now call globalism, but in American foreign policy. And it's just striking how there's been consensus among American politicians for two centuries, more than two centuries now, that that is not just our, what our, we have the right to do that, but that it is our duty. Every single one of them, until Trump, every single one of them, Republican and Democrat, has said that.
Yeah.
That's what makes America exceptional.
Yeah.
We are the best. But if you're the best, well, then you're obligated, aren't you, to make other people live the way you do?
Mm.
Otherwise, you're just being selfish.
Mm.
It's really something. So here's a problem I know that you ran into with the left with your book. A lot of them accused you of being insufficiently socialist or insufficiently Marxist. And they have a point on this because, right, Marxism obviously is internationalist. It's an internationalist ideology, right?
Mm.
It's the working class knows no borders. And the socialism has always been internationalist in most of its iterations. I think that may be a little bit different now. And that's what I was asking when I was asking about your connections with the European left, because I think that's one of the things that's we've seen recently on the left, which is the way in which it's sort of similar to the right, is that it has become actually more skeptical, at least, of internationalism, the way you are.
Mm.
And so Bernie Sanders in this country is the example.
Mm.
Bernie Sanders has been hostile to immigration his entire career. And most people don't even know that. A lot of his fans don't even know that. He has been, from my perspective, from an open borders perspective, terrible in immigration. And that's an old left labor position, right? Labor, the labor movement in every country has typically been anti-immigration for, you know, real base economic reasons, because it's competition with cheaper labor. So at least makes some sense on an economic level. But Bernie's been terrible. And also he's wanted to seal off the borders from trade, international trade. And so he thinks that it actually is oppressing Chinese people to purchase their goods here. So he's been a protectionist in that way, just like Trump. So there he is, Trump, Bernie and Trump are almost identical on those two major issues. And then when it comes to foreign policy, I mean, you know, I don't know about, I mean, Bernie's supported Israel pretty much through and through. He supported the drone war, the terror war. He's not so fond of regime change, but I think it's only because it was the bad guys who were running the regime change in Iraq, the Republicans. But there's a lot of overlap, I think, between the two. And I think in Europe, there's definitely a left-wing nationalism, right? And so the Scandinavian countries are classic examples. I mean, and so now, especially with the refugees, that's a lot of the left in Europe is having a similar response to the right, in that they're saying, oh yeah, we want a very well-developed welfare state. We want essentially socialism. We're all for that collectivism, but we just don't want to share it. Nor do we want to extend it. We just want to keep it right here in Norway, right? And so I was just wondering if you were kind of part of that or saw that or...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, like, in Ireland, for example, it's totally not considered right-wing to be a nationalist, you know?
Oh, that's right. It's a funny thing about Ireland.
Yeah.
Because I know in the States, and in fact, Bernadette Devlin came to my house when I was a kid.
No way.
Yeah, one of the leaders of the IRA. So because I believe, right? Wasn't she IRA? Was she formerly IRA or was she just sort of like a fellow traveler?
A fellow traveler would be the best way.
Yeah.
She was actually civil rights campaigner.
She was kind of soft on the IRA or whatever. I mean, sympathetic to the IRA, right? Yeah. So yeah. But the IRA and Irish republicanism we've always been very romantic about it in this country. It's very odd. Like, you don't see much criticism of that here. And I don't know why exactly, but...
So
nationalism is cool. It's funny. One of my friends once said, this is ages ago, I had made some criticism of black nationalism. I forget what it was. And he says, oh, it's interesting, but you have no criticism of Irish nationalism. Like, you got a point there.
Yeah. But you know, you also saw it though, even like if you think back to the anti-austerity kind of moment that I was talking about, I remember when, you know, when all the people were gathered in the public square and in Greece, like protesting, the bank bailout and stuff like that. And there were Greek flags everywhere, you know? So I do think that, maybe with the exception of Germany, you know, because of their history, they're very squeamish about the national flag.
Also because they're the richest and most powerful country.
Yeah.
And they, guess who runs the EU?
Yeah,
Germany.
Exactly.
So they love internationalism these days.
Yeah,
because it means, you know, Germification.
Yes.
Germanification of the Europe,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is definitely... I think that nationalism, and you also see this with like Mélenchon in France, you know, trying to have a kind of a left-wing nationalism, you know, and, you know, so that's definitely there. I mean, the borders question is such a difficult one. I mean, so on the one hand, there is an open borders left, right? But there is then the more social democratic or laborite left, which has to be in a way not in favor
That's
of
right.
open borders, because they need to plan the economy to some extent and to control the supply of labor and so on.
Well, also if you are committed to egalitarianism, truly committed to that principle first, then the first thing to be done if you live in the United States or Europe is to give all your money to the third world.
Mm.
Right? Because if the principle is egalitarianism, right, this is Rousseau's principle, it's universal.
Mm.
It wasn't just, he didn't say, oh, just in France, we should have equality.
Yeah.
The whole world should be equal. And so Bernie, I always said this to the Bernie people here. I was like, oh yeah, okay. If you're really committed to equality, then why are you not, because every American is rich, basically, compared to the rest of the world. You need to be giving up your dough right now. You should be sending it to Mexico immediately.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of people on the left don't want to admit that there is nationalism implicit in what they are for, you know. Yeah, that's undoubtedly true. I mean, the AfD, the right-wing party in Germany, last time I was over there, I was looking at their posters, and their posters were just ingenious. Everyone else had these generic posters with a smiling person saying, vote for me. They had these like very abstract kind of images. And one of them was, I think it was like vultures on a pole. And it said something like, the welfare state needs borders.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, kind of does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Until we have so much money that we can distribute it equally across the globe. Yeah. We're going to have borders. Otherwise, everybody will be poor if we equally distribute all the world's wealth.
Yeah. I mean, there are also certain patterns of migration. Like, I think about this a lot because of the fact that my parents moved, you know, and that's why they had me in another country. And also because Ireland is actually is a high emigration country, you know. And so we have this constant problem of, you know, brain drain, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
The collective, you know, wealth of the Irish people is like poured into educating this professional class who all just leave, you know.
They're all Americans now. Like you,
two groups of people.
You're part of the brain.
Yeah. Two groups of people leave: the professional, educated class, and the people at the very bottom, who are the lowest earning people, who are going to get, who are going to lose their jobs quickest, basically, when things go under. And so, you know, they then supply both, you know, cheap labor and a pre-trained, ready-made professional class to already the wealthiest countries in the world. So I don't know, is that fair? Is that good? Is that egalitarian? I'm not sure it is.
Yeah, I mean, but if you're a real Marxist, I mean, you're for global redistribution.
Yeah, I don't know, I mean, because
that's what Marxists say.
But internationalism was until, you know, internationalism was not supposed to be open borders, as I have always understood it. It was friendship between nations, friendship and cooperation between nations.
Hmm.
That implies that you have nations, otherwise it wouldn't be internationalism. If there are no borders, then there are no nations.
Yeah, I mean, of course, there are many different varieties of leftism and Marxism, but I think so. My parents were members of the International Socialists.
Mm.
That was the name of their group. And most socialist groups, or a lot of them, had the word international in them.
Mm.
And it wasn't just about friendship. I mean, Marx said the working class has no borders.
Mm.
And I liked him for saying that. I like that sentiment. But then when you keep going with the ideology, then there's got to be some forced redistribution that's global, which means that we got to give up our money. We got to give up our stuff, because there's a lot of poor people in the world who don't live here. And so if you're truly, truly committed to egalitarianism, that's the first thing you should be doing, I think. But I just find it interesting that the left and the right are both giving up this universalism now. I think there's more and more of it. The Bernie movement was very much, I think, a left-wing nationalist movement. I think that there's, as I said, the Scandinavian social welfare, social democratic parties and movements. And even in the UK and in France, you know, they're moving, they really are nationalist already. I mean, they're already, you know, they're for tight borders and more now than ever. So,
well, I'm not surprised by this because, you know, if you think of something like, you know, like I was saying earlier about how the demos of like Europe is too big, you know, like at a certain point, I think the nation state is pretty much as big as you can get, where you can still feel some sense of this is my extended family or these are my people, right? So if you talk about who are the people, you know, it, you can't love everyone, right? It's that means you love no one. The you know what I mean? Like, I just don't think that people people work that way. There has to be, you know, I mean, even, you know, you could even say the nation state is too big.
That's where I was going. Especially the one that you're sitting in right now. So it's more than 350 million people. And I've never been to Texas, where you're from, where you were born. And just Texas alone is the size of many countries. It's larger than many countries. A lot of people in Texas don't know most other Texans. Right? It's just too big. It's impossible. Yeah. I'm for decentralism and the devolution of power as much as possible, just always fighting against the centralization of power. So that's why I'm pro-Brexit, even though I'm also open borders. I'm for open borders. And I know that was one of the major motivations behind the Brexit movement was to stop immigration. Nonetheless, I think that the breaking up of that political entity is a good thing. And I want more of it. I want every country to exit. And I want the United States to break apart into as many pieces as possible. I think it's just a good thing for a lot of reasons. And one of them is that, and I've talked a lot about this on this podcast, the United States military arsenal can kill everybody on this planet hundreds of times over. And they simply couldn't have that much of a military stockpile without a massive economy. And they can't have a massive economy without a huge nation state full of people. Right. So if you decentralize, there cannot be militaries that large. They will have militaries for sure that can kill people, but nothing like what we have here. And look who has his finger right next to the button, you know, and there will be worse than Trump at some point. Scarier people than Trump. So I just want to take away that weapon. And I think that the left should be thinking, I like the direction the left is going in on this, at least those people on the left who are moving there, but they should be thinking about this more. Decentralism is generally a good thing, even if along the way we do some stuff that I don't agree with, or the new political entities do things that I don't like. Generally speaking, just for the sake of humanity, actually, I think that's really the most important thing.
I do have one major fear, though, about the EU breaking up, which is that, you know, one of the things that kept, as I said, after two world wars, you know, one of the ideas was that Europe would be so economically integrated that and so reliant on each other's economies that it would not be in anyone's interest to start a conflict with any other state. And I know we can't just have, you know, we can't just have bad, you know, institutions because we might go to war if we do something else. But, you know, it was a long period of peace in otherwise war-torn continents.
70 years, so. no war in Europe. Well, no. No world war in Europe.
And I do think sometimes, I mean, if it ever happens again, we'll look back and think of the Brexit moment as like when it all fell apart, you know.
But then again, the EU was established in NATO countries. It was really established around NATO. And so what we have now is the two largest military powers in human history, which is NATO with the United States, and then on the other side, Russia and its own allies, which include now Iran. So I don't know. I mean, what we could have created are the conditions for the biggest world war, a simplified world war. There's just two sides, but the two sides can kill everybody on Earth. And they couldn't do that in 1941 or two or three. So I don't know. We haven't seen that yet, but I'm saying that's what scares me more than anything else. And so that's why I applaud in general, decentralism of any kind. So you were born in Texas. Then why did are your parents American?
No, they're Irish.
Oh, what were they doing in Texas, for God's sake? It's hot there.
Yeah, they just went to America, and then they originally landed in Arizona because they had one relative who was there. And I think it was just basically like Houston had a sort of boom at the time. There were lots of jobs. They went where the jobs were.
And then why did they move back?
I think they just got homesick after a while, and they, you know, wanted to be with family and all that kind of stuff.
And so you have a documentary out. It just came out, right? Or not, sorry, my bad. It's not your documentary, yeah. But it's a documentary put out by Fusion TV, right?
Yeah.
And it's based on your book.
Yeah. Okay. So the director is Leighton Woodhouse, who's kind of best known for his work with The Intercept. And he wanted to do a documentary about the alt-right, and he decided to base it on my book. So it's kind of his interpretation of my book, and I'm interviewed in it, and I do some voiceover in it. But otherwise, you know, it's not, I didn't direct it, or I didn't have massive amounts of, you know, creative input or anything like that. And yeah, it's a kind of a TV hour, so it's 45 minutes or something like that.
And it's called Trumpland, Kill All Normies.
Yeah.
And the argument that's put forward, it's made central, I think, you told me in the documentary, is this thesis that's pretty minor in your book, which is that the alt-right is really an expression of sexual frustration among a lot of young men. And I think that's actually a reasonable argument.
Yeah.
But that's not a major part of your book, actually.
No, the documentary does it in these kind of... The documentary is structured in kind of chapters. So I think the first thing is the manosphere, and then the next thing, and then there's one on safe spaces and a couple of others, and it sort of ends with white nationalism. So it's, I suppose you could draw from that, you could say that it's implying that these are all following from each other, but doesn't really do that very explicitly at all.
See, yeah.
But what happened was ABC did a little 5-minute segment about the documentary.
Okay.
And they said, Nagel's thesis is that the alt-right is actually caused by sexual frustration.
Okay.
And these guys can't get a date, which I was so embarrassed by, because I would never say that.
Yeah, I wouldn't put it that way, but I do think the sexual frustration thesis about the alt-right,
oh yeah, there's something to it. There's no question.
And there's a lot there.
Yeah, it's not a shallow point to make, because it has to do with patterns that have emerged with the breakdown of the nuclear family as a norm, and monogamy and stuff like that. And so there is, if you like, a bit more of a free market of people getting to choose who they sleep with. And that has become a lot more hierarchical in a way. And so, you know, so sometimes the alt-right would joke that like monogamy is like sexual socialism.
Wow.
One for everyone.
That's,
you know,
good.
Just one each.
I like that.
And whereas when it's a, you know, a freer system, you have, you know, the guys at the top who are getting all the women, and then this large group of angry sort of young men who feel they have no options.
Right. That's interesting. I like that. I keep thinking about your earlier thesis about that it might be, this phenomenon might be largely explained by a lot of young men spending a lot of time on porn sites and going further, deeper and deeper into porn, and getting to a point in the porn world where they get scared and see this sort of nihilistic, chaotic, scary place, and then respond the way that a lot of Germans did to Weimar by seeking out people like Jordan Peterson, who are here to restore order. That's what Jordan Peterson's all about. Mm. Restore order. That's what he says. I like that a lot. I mean, we can't prove it, but it makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
But the other thing about the sexual frustration piece, to be a heterosexual man in America is to live most of your life with sexual frustration, to experience sexual frustration every day for most of the day. Because in this country in particular, there's this schizoid relationship with sex, right? So we are simultaneously puritanical. Europeans know this, but they look at us and they're like, why do you care so much that Bill Clinton got a blowjob? And also obviously incredibly hedonistic.
Yeah.
So it's this bizarre thing, this split in our culture. So we are inundated with pictures of chicks in bikinis.
Yeah.
But also we're told constantly to wear a business suit and button up and cover up and be serious and rational and don't ever talk about sex. And if you even suggest, even if you talk about sex with a female colleague, you are the same as a rapist, basically. And my goodness, that can create some frustration. So, and in porn, of course, we're awash in porn. So it's, but it's everywhere, but also nowhere simultaneously, because you never see it anywhere. But we know it's one of the biggest industries in the world, and that the vast majority of American men watch porn, but it's also never talked about. And so we're in this constant, terrible, painful conflict, in a sense. I think it affects women too, but I know for men, I think this is just a constant thing. Even men who are popular and attractive and have girlfriends, and even for them, I think there's a lot of frustration because of this particular contradictory culture we live in.
Yeah, it's a mess. I was speaking to a friend of mine who's a writer who's like, you know, in his early 20s recently, and we were talking about the Me Too thing. And he said, and I know he was completely sincere, you know, I have absolutely no hope about the future of relations between the sexes.
Wow.
I am never speaking to it. Like in the workplace, I'm never going to be in a room with a woman on my own. I am going to be thinking about this constantly. Yeah. And it's exactly that. It's sort of like you can watch any kind of extreme porn you want as often as you want, but you can't have like the normal things that most people have had for all of human
history. Apparently it's not okay to ask someone out on a date.
Yeah.
In the workplace.
I actually did think that the rejection of Me Too in France and Italy was like a great act of like anti-cultural imperialism.
The letter, you know? Catherine Deneuve letter. I love that letter. Love that letter. That's the best of feminism right there. That's the feminism that I identify with, and that I think is just, that's the best. And unfortunately, in this country, that brand of feminism is dead.
Yeah.
There is almost, there is pretty much no one in this country who says that. I mean, you won't find, there were in the 70s and 80s, there were a bunch of great so-called pro-sex feminists or sex-positive feminists like that who made those arguments that those French intellectuals did in that letter. But yeah, it's gone. I don't know, this country, I mean, hopefully it'll come back, but your friend has a point. I despair for the culture of this country in that way. Thank you for doing this. I really appreciate it. I love your book, and I think it's a watershed, actually. And I hope, well, I think a lot of the left is reading it and thinking about it and changing their minds on some things in what I think are good ways. So that's why I invited you to
do this.
And I really, really appreciate it. And I hope you keep doing what you're doing. And I can't wait for your, are you going to do another book?
Yeah. As soon as I can come up with an idea, I'm sure I feel it has to be really big and ambitious, the next one, you know.
I have no recommendations for what it should be. Whatever you do, I think it'll certainly be interesting. So thanks.
Well, thank you.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To sign up for the Renegade University webinars, visit thaddeusrussell.com/courses. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. Thanks for listening.